Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Chartock of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. This week, Governor Cuomo released his $44 billion state budget. We'll take a look at that mighty document, and we'll get reactions to his budgetary plan. New guidelines have been established to protect court personnel from potentially dangerous AIDS victims. We'll take a look at that story and the problem of accidental toxic waste spills in New York. It's all coming up on this week's Legislative Gazette. New York State Governor Mario Cuomo unveiled a $44.2 billion state budget for 1988 and 89. His plan calls for no major new tax hikes, but it does represent an 8.3% spending increase over last year, or if you believe him, something under 7%. Bruce Robertson has the story.
Governor Cuomo kept the growth of the state's general fund under 7%, and this is considered to be the best barometer of state-controlled spending. In his State of the State address, Cuomo dubbed the next 10 years as the decade of the child. He appears to be keeping with his promise to try to provide New York children with better futures. His budget proposal includes more than $60 million for child care, almost $90 million for new Medicaid plans aimed at children and pregnant women, and an increase in education spending. Education, says Cuomo, is his number one concern.
Education, of course, is a top priority. And with the recommendations I propose in this budget, state support for education this year will exceed $7.6 billion for elementary and secondary education. That's an increase of over 65%, or $3 billion, since I became governor January 1, 1983. 65% increase.
Cuomo is proposing $25 million for a new universal pre-kindergarten program for the state's four-year-olds. He's also asking for almost $17 million for tuition assistance programs, which is an increase over last year. Rebuilding the state's roadways and bridges is also a primary concern of the governor's. He's proposing that $1.4 billion be spent to improve and maintain the state's roads and bridges, and almost a quarter of that money, or $335 million, will be coming from the Infrastructure Trust Fund.
We have recommended half of it for roads and bridges. And with those funds, with the half of $670 million, we can repair 150 deficient state bridges. We can pave 1,000 lane miles of state roads, and we can increase the capacity of our highway network.
Solid waste is another one of the issues very important to the governor.
Solid waste is a great and growing problem. It's time, I think, that the state became more aggressive in doing two things: in aiding local governments, we have to help them every way we can, and in prodding local governments that could do the job, that could afford to do the job, but choose not to because it's too difficult politically, or because they don't want to spend their money, they want to spend yours. So what we need to do is to prod those local governments that simply refuse to do the right thing, and there are some. I know, I've spoken to them. And they'll come up and tell you, Mario, yeah, we don't want to do it, it's too hard. It's too hard politically to go and pick a site. And I'll tell you what I've said to them, Democrats and Republicans alike. Well then, get out of your job.
But despite Cuomo's hardline approach, he has called for the expenditure of more than $100 million for solid waste management. About half of this will be dedicated to the expensive procedures required to make old landfills environmentally safe. Another $7.5 million has been proposed to be used as grants for local governments to develop regional solid waste management plans. The proposed budget also calls for an increase of 62% in state support for agricultural programs, aid to low-income housing, and provisions for a series of medium security prisons in Cayuga, Franklin, and Oneida counties, and a shock incarceration facility in Wayne County. Finally, as a footnote, to help put the size of the proposed budget into perspective, experts have revealed that this year's figure is the equivalent of the 1984 gross national product of Yugoslavia. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Bruce Robertson.
Well, you heard some of the details of the governor's proposed budget plan, but I asked Fred Dicker, Capitol Bureau Chief of the New York Post, what he thought about this year's budget.
Well, I always find them interesting, Alan. It certainly wasn't an unexpected budget, if I can get the word out properly. It was not unexpected. The governor, in his State of the State address earlier this month, made clear, I think, that he had disclosed much of what we would later see in the budget, and he was right. The budget's up about 6.5% if you want to buy the governor's line, or about 8.3% if you want to look at the real numbers. But in any event, that's about what the New York State budget goes up every year. Without doing anything, this state can count on something like $2 billion in new revenues as a result of what they call normal growth in the economy, and then as a result of some additional monies that invariably come in from the federal government. So one can always be sure that, say, between $2 or $3 billion more will be spent in each year than was spent the year before.
Okay, let's talk about this real fast, because there are a number of things we have to cover. Number one, he says he doesn't have to raise taxes. Yes or no?
Now, he's correct. I mean, but that's no major concession, Alan. Let's face the fact that the legislature and the governor have agreed to a multi-year tax reduction program. He agreed to that last year. That tax reduction is the law. For him now to say, well, I don't have to raise taxes is a bit disingenuous.
But you and I both know how funny he can be and what a fierce opponent he can be.
Sure.
He's coming on. He knows very well that the Republican huge initiative this year is in, for example, in the area of landfills. They want to help the counties set up landfills now that the Department of Environmental Conservation has said they got to close almost everything
yeah.
they have. And they want a lot of money. He says up to $3 billion, although where he gets that number from, I don't know.
Sure.
And he says he's got a pittance in there. He throws them a couple of pennies, literally.
Oh, yeah.
To help them. Now, he says, if you want more than that, you've got to come and beg me to spend more money, and that's tax money, and I refuse to raise taxes, and he's got them in a bit of a barrel.
He doesn't. He's playing his old game, and you're quite right when you say how good he is at it, but when push comes to shove, as we both know, it's the legislature that approves the new budget, not the governor, and they can change priorities. I know you've been saying for some time that you think this landfill solid waste issue is going to be big this year. Of course, you know I disagree with you. I think roads are of far more interest to the Senate Republicans than landfills are. But in any event, I think we're going to see a reordering of the priorities by the legislature, which after all is up for re-election this year, and that's what's going to happen between now and April 1, the time when more or less the budget gets adopted.
Well, I don't know if you've come from Mars or not, but they're all talking about the landfill, and I take them seriously. But, you know, Fred, you name a very interesting point there when you say that they're interested in roads, and this foxy governor knows they're interested in roads. So what does he do? He says, okay, we've got this infrastructure money here in New York, this fund. What we'll do is we'll take half the money for the roads and the other half we'll take for housing. Now, that's going to go over like a lead balloon in the state Senate.
No, you're absolutely correct. We've already seen Norman Levy, who's the powerful head of the Senate Transportation Committee, use the word unacceptable to characterize the governor's proposal split of that money. He doesn't want as much as the governor wants going to housing. He wants it to go to roads, preferably in suburban areas like Nassau County.
So we can look forward to a real hot debating on that subject.
I think so, although, you know, we heard something interesting just a little while ago. Melvin Miller, who last year, I think, made the major political error of challenging the governor, and he is, after all, like Cuomo, a Democrat, came out of a briefing that the governor gave on the budget and said, well, these are difficult times for the economy. Maybe the governor's right. We have to be cautious. And I would note also that here it is the day the governor's budget comes out, and the Senate Republicans are saying, well, we're not going to react until tomorrow. I think there is a recognition that the economy is volatile, that these are not rosy times necessarily, and the fighting over the budget may not be as great as we would have otherwise expected.
Now, Fred, let's talk for just a second about the national implications of all of this. Here's
sure.
this Democratic governor being very parsimonious and saying, you know, you got to prove to me if you want to spend a dime, you got to beg me for it and the rest of it. This is sort of turning things around and may be an interesting positioning for a national constituency.
Well, Alan, I've been saying for some time, and I think you would back me up on this, that the governor is a master of having it both ways. I mean, he is fabulous as a politician. Just the fact that you accept the premise that this is a tight budget, I think, shows how good he is. I mean, this budget is up 8.3% or 6.5%, however you want to calculate it. In either event, it's up above the rate of inflation in this state. It's up above the governor's own proposal from last year for a cap on state spending. Now, he's going to run around saying that this is fiscally prudent, that he's essentially a conservative, yet the whole emphasis of the budget's increases are on social spending programs. Now, I'm not suggesting that's bad, but I'm suggesting that he will succeed, as I think he has with you, of having it both ways. He presents a liberal budget for liberals and a conservative budget for conservatives, and he can run around the country saying this is what a politician is supposed to do, satisfy both sides. And as we know from the Marist poll that came out earlier this week, that's what he's been doing.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post. The chief administrative judge of New York's court system has set new guidelines to protect court personnel from people with infectious diseases, including AIDS. Brenda McMahon reports.
New York State's Chief Administrative Judge Albert Rosenblatt is the first in the nation to issue protective guidelines for court judges when they feel cases involving AIDS victims may be dangerous to court attendance. Rosenblatt says these guidelines were necessary because of a number of altercations which occurred in the courtroom. In one case, a criminal defendant claiming to be infected with the AIDS disease purposely bit a security officer. He says the guidelines attempt to balance the security needs of court personnel with the personal rights of all individuals.
The objective in the guidelines was to create and develop a uniform, instructive policy for the treatment of such individuals when they come into a courtroom that reflects both a sense of safety for the court officers and for those who come into contact with people that have infectious diseases, and in the balance to maintain the kind of dignity and decorum and tranquility that courts should have.
In any case in which a person is believed to have the AIDS virus, the court guidelines allow all judges to ask if the person has an infectious disease. And if the judge deems the person dangerous, he may inform the court of the person's disease. A judge may also rearrange the seating, remove or secure objects that may cause injuries, and as Rosenblatt explains, a judge can provide plastic masks and gloves for security personnel responsible for the defendant.
Uniformly, we in the court system are supplying surgical gloves and surgical masks to any court officers or anyone else who are in the role of security people, like a sheriff's deputy or in other instances they might be called attendants, but basically court officers that fill positions of security, and that these devices, as well as other protective devices like restraining bars, should be made available but kept out of view, and that they should be exhibited or used in court only when there is direct physical confrontational contact threatened or when it's called for by existing circumstances.
And how will these guidelines affect jurors' perceptions in individual cases? Rosenblatt says each case is different, and presiding judges must decide if such precautions will affect the outcome of the trial.
You get into another issue with juries and how a judge deal with a case in which someone afflicted with AIDS appears in a trial that involves a jury. The way in which and the extent to which that is to be made known is something that rests with the discretion of the judge, because it goes right to the heart of the adjudicative process. It could have a bearing on the perception of the jury, and for that reason it resides exclusively and properly within the individual discretion of the trial judge.
Rosenblatt says it took a long time to draw up these guidelines, and he acknowledges that they are controversial.
I would have no doubt that some people say that the guidelines go too far, and that they're too one-sided, and that they reflect too much of a concern for the safety of court officers at the expense of the atmosphere in the courtroom, and that there might be those who on the other side say that they don't go far enough in authorizing the routine wearing of all manner of garb. So I'm sure that you'll get the entire range of reactions, but my expectation is that a reasoned evaluation, which is to say by most people, will find them to be comprehensible and entirely rational and workable.
Albert Rosenblatt is the Chief Administrative Judge of the New York State Court System. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Brenda McMahon.
A recent study showed that accidental toxic waste spills have dramatically increased over last year. Paul Rosenthal tells us what the state says it's going to do about this problem.
Can the Bhopal chemical accident of 1984 occur in New York State? Attorney General Robert Abrams met with Environmental Conservation Commissioner Thomas Jorling and Assemblymen Maurice Hinchy and Eric Vitaliano, all of whom support a joint bill submitted by Governor Cuomo and the Attorney General dealing with the prevention of toxic chemical accidents.
After Bhopal occurred back in 1984, I launched a series of hearings in Albany, in New York City, and Niagara Falls to determine whether or not Bhopal could happen here in New York State. And unfortunately, we got voluminous testimony from experts and local officials and residents of communities talking about episodes, accidents, the kind of dangers that exist with the failure of New York to have a regulatory or statutory framework to properly respond to accidents once they occur, but even more importantly, to try to prevent these accidents from occurring in the first instance. And so we developed legislation that has been introduced. Last year it passed the state assembly, but it has not cleared the state senate.
Abrams sent a letter to Senate Majority Leader Warren Anderson outlining the latest numbers and statistical data. Abrams says it's important information.
For the first 9 months of 1987, the rate of reported toxic chemical accidents has doubled, and that brings for a grand total of the last 4 years some 2,000 accidents, 500 injuries, 26 deaths, and tens of thousands of people who had to be evacuated from their offices or their homes as a result of these toxic chemical accidents. So we need legislation, and this bill is very simple. It's very basic. It seeks to prevent accidents by requiring those who either produce toxic chemicals or inventory or store them or handle them to develop risk assessment or management plans that would seek to identify potential hazards and then institute programs to reduce those hazards so that we would not have as many accidents occurring in the future.
Why, if the legislation is so important, is it being held back in the Senate? Abrams says that there are some elements of the chemical industry that are not supportive of this legislation.
The problem is that you just can't allow companies to do this on a voluntary basis, which is one of the positions of the chemical association or industry. There are over 13,000 sites in New York where toxic chemicals are either manufactured or they're warehoused, and a lot of those companies, you know, may well do this voluntarily, but many of them won't. And therefore, it requires the compulsion of government to have them develop these plans, which, by the way, are not only in the public's interest, but it's in the economic self-interest of these companies. Because if they improve the way in which they do business in trying to prevent, highlight the risks and prevent these accidents from happening in the future, they're going to have fewer lawsuits brought against them. They're going to pay out less in monetary damages to claimants. They're going to have lower insurance rates. So it's wise from every perspective to pass this legislation, and I hope that 1988 is going to be the year when it happens.
General Electric Silicone on the Hudson north of Albany was on the top of the list of companies that had the highest number of hazardous chemical accidents in the state. Abrams, however, pointed out that GE also spent a lot of time and money cleaning up their spills. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Paul Rosenthal.
As we reported earlier, Governor Cuomo's proposed budget included a list of his priorities, one of which is housing. I asked Assemblyman Alexander Pete Granis, chairman of the Housing Committee, why he thought the governor listed housing as one of this year's important issues.
Well, I think he's recognized that housing is very high on people's agenda. It's everybody's agenda. It comes up with the number of people that are homeless. It comes up with repeated references to young couples that can't afford a place to live. In our own state, it's been mentioned as the Achilles heel on the city's, New York City's ability to grow and expand into the future. I think it's a very, very important issue, a substantive issue, and this year it's become a political issue. And I think that's very good for those of us that are concerned about housing matters.
But if you go out on the street and you say to people, tell me what the most important things the state has to consider this year, it's very doubtful. I mean, we've seen these lists already. It's very doubtful that anybody's going to say housing.
Yeah, for the people on the street, housing probably is not a high agenda item. On the long-range planning agenda, it is. I think people are concerned, those are people that are looking at some of these issues, unless you run into a lot of homeless people, go down and ask that same question in the shelters, or for the young couple that is spending their sixth day looking for a place that they can afford, I think you'll find something very different. Most people have a house today, have a place to live, and for those, it's not a problem. Into the future, it's going to be their children that face some of these problems, or their parents. The elderly have a very difficult housing problem today and into the future. On the aging agenda, housing is right at the top, we're told, by surveys that have been done by the state's Office for the Aging.
And of course, housing for the mentally ill, the mentally retarded, that's all raised by their commission, the respective commissioners in those departments.
Yeah, they're all talking about housing, special housing for people with developmental disabilities, special housing for people that have drug problems and alcohol problems, that are battered women have very special housing needs.
Pete, now, nobody needs to know, although it certainly is interesting. You come from Manhattan, where housing is big stuff. You've made your reputation as a housing expert, as an intervener on housing. Tenants' rights, coalitions. Is this a downstate as opposed to an upstate problem?
No, I think it's a statewide problem. There are terrific housing problems up around Fort Drum. We discovered in some of our hearings out in Buffalo, as a recovering economy has given more people more money to live better. The availability of affordable housing is a real issue. In Long Island, it's a pressing issue for their big companies. They can't afford to get the young professionals to come into Long Island because they can't afford a place to live. And a special association of the Long Island Association has been put together to try and look at this issue of affordable housing. It's everywhere in the state, and I would suggest to you in many, many areas of the country.
Okay, Pete, what do we have to do in order to make our housing crunch less severe? What are the practical steps we have to take?
Well, first and foremost is money, and the governor is, at least in his State of the State speech, and I think will be making a substantial commitment of state resources to housing.
Yes, he said so at budget school today, which I've just come back from.
So yeah, that's number one.
Right.
And number two, I think you have to have people that run housing programs that understand their complexity and understand the need for fast production of affordable housing. I think you need professional managers with the commitment and the support, both sides of the equation.
Where do you get them from, Pete?
Well, I think you do for housing what we have just done in the city of New York for education. You look all across the country. You put out a talent search. You conduct a talent search to find people that are the best people you can find in the country, if not in the state, to run these programs.
Okay, how many have we made real mistakes in the way we've developed public housing, for example, in the past?
No, not mistakes. I think what happened was that the economy changed faster than we were able to adjust to protect the housing that we had. The difficulty in the past has been that we built great big housing projects
right.
with large amounts of federal money. We don't have those federal resources now, and we still have not adjusted our thinking to the fact that we have to use state and local resources in the private sector.
But a lot of people say that those public housing projects became sort of institutionalized ghettos, that people didn't take care of them, that they collapsed, that they had in many cases to even be abandoned. What about that?
I think there's some truth to some of that we had it in place and took it as a given that it was there and then didn't look after it. It depends on which housing authority you look at. Some in the western part of the state, Buffalo, the Buffalo Housing Authority, has a terrible reputation and lots of problems. The City Housing Authority has 178,000 apartments.
I'm talking about New York City now.
Yeah, New York City is considered one of the best housing authorities in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, that's where the poor people live in those housing projects, and they will continue to live there if we can't provide any of their housing options outside of those kinds of projects.
Okay, now, the governor says that he wants to take some of this money from this fund that is created in New York for infrastructure, I believe. Now, let me ask you this. How likely is the state Senate to go along with that? Because traditionally, the major New York City landlords groups have lobbied the Senate primarily as opposed to your house, the Assembly.
Right. Well, I think the governor's committed to split this big fund in half, half for highways and bridge repairs and half for housing. The Assembly is supporting that position. The money can't be spent without the Assembly's signing off on it. And I think it's going to be a matter of real tough negotiation between the Senate, the Assembly, and the governor to try and ensure that that money goes to housing. I think we're going to have to settle for a negotiated agreement, and I'm hoping it's 50-50.
Assemblyman Pete Granis. Although Governor Cuomo won't tell us which Democratic presidential hopeful he's going to endorse for the nomination, if he in fact does, he has been discussing his options with Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. Dave Gilletly spoke with the LG about their mutual decision.
Well, we haven't had any really extensive discussion about the commitment of the governor and lieutenant governor to a candidate. We discussed the candidates very actively. Of course, I know several of the candidates very well, having served with them in Congress, Gore, Gebhardt, Simon particularly. I know Jesse Jackson and Mike Dukakis fairly well. I'm not as well acquainted with Bruce Babbitt, although I'm very impressed with him. I think that the Democrats have some outstanding candidates here. It seems to us that we ought to look at the results of the early primaries and caucuses and then make a judgment as to whether or not we are going to endorse prior to the April 19th primary in New York. The governor and I will candidly and hopefully in detail discuss this campaign, and we will act together. We will do whatever is in the best interest of electing a Democratic president in 1988.
But is there a Cuomo-Lundeen short list?
No. I would not say, as far as I'm concerned, that we have ruled any of the candidates out or that we are in a final selection process. I think both analysis and events will assist us in determining how we can be most helpful to the overall effort to elect the best president possible.
If you had to choose one today, could you?
No. I would be very reluctant to choose a candidate today. And if you were the governor and we weren't on the radio and we were just in the privacy, let's say, of my office, although we usually confer in his, I would tell you no. I think it would be a mistake. If you asked me who should we choose today, my answer would be no one. Not yet. It would be a mistake. Paul Simon is a very good friend of mine, and I have just utter confidence in his integrity, his ability. But I don't think he's really been out there enough in the national scene so that we know his appeal to voters, his ability to make the kind of a campaign that will be necessary to win. And it will be difficult to win. The Republicans have gotten a lot of publicity, particularly Vice President Bush and Senator Dole. And it'll be a challenge for the Democrats to win. In effect, we're the party out of power, and we're going to have to mount a challenge to unseat those who are in power.
Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. And that's it for this week's Legislative Gazette. The show was produced by Brenda McMahon, and she had help this week from Bruce Robinson, Paul Rosenthal, Dave Gilletly, and Inga Sarda. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll tune in again next week to hear about the news and events in and around the Empire State. Until then, I'm Alan Charta.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University College at New Paltz.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.